So this week we're Parshat Vayetze. Vayetze, of course, has a wonderful introduction. That introduction is that Yaakov is sent away. If we look to the very end of last week's Parsha, Yaakov was sent away by both his mother and his father, albeit for two different reasons. Although there is a little bit of chesed involved in this, this is the first time that we can tell that the two of them told him to do the same thing. So it could be two different motivations, but they both told him to go, and they both told him to go to the same place. So Yaakov goes. V'yisa Yaakov raglecha v'yilech arza b'nei kedem. Now, what we're starting up over here in Perek Kavtet is after Yaakov has his dream, after he has his epiphany, after he sees the ladder, or to be more accurate, he sees the sulam. The reason I say to be more accurate is that the word sulam is only mentioned once in the Torah, so we're assuming it means a ladder. It could be other kinds of things, something which has its feet on the ground and has its head up in the sky, which is a similar description to what we saw by the Migdal Bavel, but it's something which, it's an edifice, that's what it would seem to be. What I think is interesting, or perhaps more than that, is important, is what is the connection between the vision that he has, which means he sees the sulam and he sees the angels. Now, here it depends if you know what it says or your mind plays tricks on you. So, I mean, when I say that, I mean, is it that the angels come down and go back up, or is it they go up and come back down? Which direction are the angels going in? And, of course, the answer is the angels are... But where do they start? They start in heaven. Right. So starting in heaven is what you would think, but it's not what it says. Living or din, is that the angels go up and then they come down. So now, so just the simple question would be, so what does that have to do with the content of what God is going to say to him? Because one would assume that the revelation that he receives, and the, when I say revelation, both in terms of visual and content, should have some connection to one another. And what's interesting is the amount of commentaries who completely separate between the two, that they'll see the, all kinds of symbolism involved in the vision, while the content seems to be a little different, or the connection would be much more haphazard. Now, I may be overstating this, but of course I've convinced myself that I'm completely correct, which is good. I mean, because that's the only chance I have of convincing all of you that I'm completely correct. And that is, I think that the vision may have more to do with what God doesn't say than with God does say. And what I mean by that is over here, God reiterates one of the brachot that Yaakov had already received. He reiterates that you are going to receive this land, and essentially it's Birkat Avraham, what Yitzchak gave him at the very end when he sent him away. What God doesn't talk about at all is that he's going to receive, or he's not going to receive, let's pause there, is that God didn't say anything about the brachot that he stole. So it could be, on the one hand, the very fact that God is speaking to him is wonderful. Oh, look at that. God will speak to me, because maybe Yaakov doesn't know if we did the right thing. But he doesn't say anything about those brachot. And what were those brachot? Those brachot were for power and wealth. So the brachot for power and wealth, apparently Yaakov is not getting. And he seems to recognize this when he wakes up and he says, you know, this is a holy place and so on. And then he makes a vow and says, and if God protects me, which is exactly what God just said he was going to do, and brings me back to my father's home, then and gives me bread to eat, right? Lechem lechov v'beged levosh. That seems to be the vow of somebody who does not think that he has a trust fund, right? If he already won the lottery, he already has all the brachot for power and wealth, he's got his trust fund waiting for him, so he's going to have everything, he has nothing to worry about. Which means the lack of wealth in Yaakov's future is something which he seems pretty convinced about, and you can say, well, that's the guilt of stealing those brachot, or is the fact that God didn't reiterate those brachot. If you want to go a little bit deeper, maybe you could even make an argument that the word he uses for clothing in this case, he could have used other words, but he uses the word beged, which has the at the root begidah, that there was some kind of deception going on over here, is interesting. Also, when God speaks to him, he says, Avraham Avicha, and he says Yitzchak, he doesn't say your father. Which also could be, okay, you didn't treat him as a father, why should I call him a father if you don't treat him as a father? So I'm saying that it could be that there's much more depth. Again, all my arguments over here are based on what it doesn't say. Now, if all of that is correct, then it could be that the symbol of the ladder could be that we have a Mishnah in Avot that tells us that when you do a mitzvah, it creates some kind of spiritual power. The Chafetz Chaim says, he explains that, and says it creates a malach. So every time you do a mitzvah, it creates a malach. Which means, how does Shefa Elokim come down? you need to create the malachim down below, and those malachim then go up into heaven, and that brings the shefa down. It's not some kind of a magical incantation. Okay, you got a bracha, and everything good is going to come. So if what I'm saying is correct, then the visual of what he sees completely connects to the what God doesn't say, which in Yaakov hears very loudly with what God doesn't say. So all that is the introduction. Because what we're going to talk about today is Yaakov's wealth or lack of wealth as we get to the next scene. And then Yaakov continues on his trip. He continues where he was sent by both his father and his mother. And he sees a well. Now, we'll just pause a second for a well. Wells are interesting to us till this point for two reasons, both in terms of his mother and in terms, well, mainly in terms of his father. Let me pause a second. It's his mother, when Eliezer or the Eved Avraham comes, is going to bring water and so on. But we also have, as we saw last week, Yitzchak is this one who redigs wells. That's part of what he is. So it's interesting that we get right back to the Be'er, the theme of the Be'er. The other thing that we need to consider, and I'm going to say this, I'm not going to do it as much as I should, but then those of you who, I mean, this is part of my fantasy, that you do homework afterwards and you think about this and you explore more. But if you do, then I think that there are two places that you need. You need to open up three different sections at once. You know, sometimes our interpretations are going to be based on opening up one section, sometimes a comparison in two sections, sometimes three sections. The three sections should be this section, and which other two? Okay, I won't put you on the spot. One would be the whole Eved Avraham Eliezer scene with Rivka. That's one thing that needs to be compared to, which I'm going to pay more attention to. And the other thing that we have to compare it to is to the Moshe scene with, also by the Be'er, with, a Be'er seems to be a good place to meet someone. Yeah, I mean, if I would open up a bar, I would definitely call it the Be'er, the well, unless the golden calf. But that, I mean, those are two different messages. So I would compare maybe that's the way to solve the Shidduch crisis, have more wells. But it seems to be that that's the way to solve it in Bereshit and Shemot, is that we have the Eliezer Rivka scene. And again, we have to see what it says in verses and what it doesn't say, and then you have to compare it to the Moshe Tzipora scene over there. And they're going to become, it goes both ways. The comparisons in both of those sections, which is why I'm saying it's not an easy one, it's only one or the other, it really is both. So it says he gets to the Be'er, v'nesfu shama kol ha'adarim v'galalu et ha'evin me'al pi ha'be'er v'hishku et ha'tzon v'hishivu et ha'evin al pi ha'be'er l'mkoma. So they uncover it and they cover it, which, by the way, if you want to go back to this Yitzchak scene, Yitzchak Avraham well, which was dug and then was undug, as it were. This is not the same thing, but it is access to water, so it could be on a smaller level. There may be some kind of similarity. And of course, what does Yitzchak do? He redigs the wells. So therefore, providing water is a Yitzchak trait, which now we could say, well, it's an Avram trait, which is there, followed by Yitzchak. So for Yitzchak here, for Yaakov then here to continue and say, oh, you know, I better uncover this well, is not so far from what we've seen his father and grandfather do. Vayomam Yaakov achai me'ayin atem, right? Where are you from? Vayomur me'charon anachnu. They say we're from Charon, which must be he's in the outskirts of Charon at this particular point. Vayomur lahem hayadatem et Lavan ben Nachor. Do you know Lavan ben Nachor? Now that's very interesting, because his name is not Lavan ben Nachor. His name, of course, is Lavan ben Betuel. So he just sort of skipped. So by the way, this is also a theme which connects to the whole Eved Avraham scene. Because in the very beginning of the scene, Betuel is there, then at some point Betuel disappears. He disappears. Now, what exactly is his disappearance? So I'm just pointing out, he has still disappeared. But now it's even more interesting, because not only has he disappeared, he's been written out of the family. So, you know, what terror, and by the way, there are midrashim that say that he did terrible, terrible things. Anybody wants to read about it? Yeah. Anyone to read about it, you have to read my book. I uncovered all kinds of terrible things that he did. The Echoes of Eden on Bereshit. Vayomer Yadanu, yeah, we know him. Vayomer Lahem, by the way, if you do want to compare it again to Yitro for whatever reason, Yitro also has numerous names. Right? So there's also, there's something there. Continue. Vayomer Lahem HaShalom Lo? is well with him. Well, here is a different well. Okay, is he fine? Is everything okay? Vayomru shalom. Yes. V'hinei Rachel bito ba'ah im hatzon. And here comes his daughter with the tzon. And by the way, that itself causes us to pause for a moment and to ask, well, one thing we don't know, and I have no way of knowing, is how old is Rachel at this particular point? And again, it's sort of like with Rivka last time. You can guess any age that you want, and I'll say, fine, I can, that works for me. I have no idea how old she is right now, and maybe it does make a difference as we continue, but what is interesting is that she's the one who's designated to be the shepherd, and is there anyone else who could be the shepherd, and why? Okay, so at least there's one older sister that we know of, so why is she the one who is the shepherd or shepherdess? I don't know. Vayomer hein od hayom gadol, which by the way is the exact opposite with Eliezer. With Eliezer, it's, or the Eved Avram, it's like right before nightfall. But here, but it's the middle of the day. Va'od hayom gadol, od hayom gadol, lo eta sefa mikneh. It's not the right time to start collecting and bringing things back home. So what's going on? Yishku otzono l'chura'u. Vayomu lo nuchal ad asher yasfu kol adarim galalua te evin me'al pi'a be'er. No, we need a group effort in order to be able to take this rock off of the well. Odenu medaber imam. He's still speaking to him, which, by the way, is very similar in language. Do I have to point out all the comparisons or no? As he was still thinking, as he was saying it, and suddenly Rivka appears. Right, right. It's very, very similar language. It'll be not precise, but very similar. Odenu medaber imam v'rachel ba im hatzon asher la'aviha ki ro'ah hi. So it's actually a little stronger than it was before. No, she is a shepherd. That's who she is. She is with her father's flock. V'ikasher ro'ah Yaakov et Rachel bat Lavan achi imo v'etzon Lavan achi imo v'yegesh Yaakov yagel to Evan me'al pi abe'er v'yashak etzon Lavan achi imo. Now there's two words that keep getting repeated in that verse at least three times. And what is that? Achi imo. And that's something that we need also to pay attention to, because that is clearly done for emphasis. What is described as achi imo? So Rachel is the daughter of Lavan achi imo, and the tzon is for Lavan achi imo. And then again, he gives water to the tzon of Lavan achi imo. And you realize that did not have to be written this way. This could have been written in a much more concise manner. Then it says Vayishak Yaakov leRachel, Vayisad kolo vayevk, and then Yaakov kisses Rachel, and then he lifts up his voice and he cries. Later on, we're going to find Yosef, again, Yosef's Yaakov's son, crying many, many times. But here we find that this part of his personality or his psyche or his emotional life comes forth, and we find this crying of Yaakov, although we're not exactly sure as we read this, why is he crying? And some commentaries will give more spiritual knowledge of the future, the Beit HaMikdash will be destroyed one day, and so on and so forth. But I can just ask you, Ein Mikra Yotzei Midei Pshuto, so why exactly is Yaakov crying at this point? For that matter, he just now went and kissed her, so it's good that Rachel didn't have Facebook, or she probably would have written me too next to it over here. So I'm in the field, and some guy comes, and he kisses me out of nowhere, and didn't even buy me... Oh, did he buy her a drink first? I guess he did buy her a drink. He bought me a drink, and now he thinks he can kiss me. He's like, what exactly is going on over here? And we will have commentaries. We'll see the Ramban Blin Eder soon, who will try to lighten this a little bit, to make it sound a little bit nicer. Hirsch also goes out of his way, hopefully we'll see that as well, to say that there's nothing erotic about this. This is completely, completely different, which, by the way, goes back to my point in terms of age, I think could make a very big difference. That if she's a 9-year-old cousin who he meets for the first time, he goes over and he kisses her. By the way, some of you can say, well, that's much worse. Or if she's 19 years old. I mean, am I wrong about this? I've many, many women in the room, so what? Right, she doesn't know this yet. By the way, those of you who want to say it's a little, again, that it is not erotic and it is a little bit nicer, notice that, what does it say? What's the word which is used here? Vayishak Yaakov liRachel, not et Rachel. So the liRachel versus et Rachel could make a difference in terms of what kind of, yeah, which is what Riella was saying. Now, the other thing which just now we'll look at the Ramban soon. I just want to point it out now already, but he'll come back to that. The other thing is, it seems to be that all these others, you have to work together to take the rock off, and Yaakov then does this himself. If we'll, again, I just want to, I'm going to come back to that in a moment, but let's just get through this section. Vayeged Yaakov l'Rachel ki achi aviyahu, v'chi ben rifkahu, v'taretz v'tageid l'aviyah. Which, by the way, he should have done first. He should have first said, you know, I am Yaakov, and so on. But it could be that he's just overwhelmed emotionally. And that's, again, the crying. Forget about that he sees his, he sees the Beit HaMikdash or whatever else it is that he may see. So, again, the crying theme will continue. But over here, this could be he's overcome by emotion. He we don't know how long he's been traveling either. I mean, unless, again, you look in the Midrashim and he spent a lot of time in yeshiva along the way. But we don't know how long he's been traveling. He's going and going and going. And it's not the same as Eliezer, but that's what I keep coming back to. And please forgive me for calling him Eliezer. I'm going to tell you why I call him Eliezer, even though he's never called Eliezer there, because Avram has a servant named Eliezer. The other thing is this person turns to God and says, you know, if Avram needs anything to do, then please do this, and God helps him. So this is whoever that guy is, it's Eliezer, because God helped him. So the same thing there, he reaches out. Eliezer reaches out to God and like practically gives a test, you know, do this and this and this for me right before the sun set. Here, the sun isn't setting. Here, it's the middle of the day. And here, he's sort of just, again, he's going in the right direction, but he finds her. Even though he put God, you know, right. let's see what you can do here.
Right.
Which the Gemara doesn't love so much in terms of his behavior. But over here, he just goes in the area and he bumps into a girl and it's her. It's her. And he knows it's her. She doesn't know it's her. And he's overcome with emotion, which, I'll say, is certainly the second part. In terms of the crying, he then reveals who he is. Vataratz vategei laviha, which, by the way, is, again, very similar to in the Rivka story. Vehi kishmo Lavan et shema Yaakov ben achoto v'yaretz lakoto v'yichabek lo v'yinashek lo v'yiveu el beito v'yisaper l'Lavan et kol dvrim ha'ele, which, again, is going to be very similar to the other story in terms of Lavan getting involved and hearing and so on. Although there is one huge difference between the two. And there's another huge difference between the two. The other huge difference is that when Eliezer showed up with lots and lots of wealth. Which means when Eliezer shows up, you know, he drives up in that stretch limousine or that stretch the stretch camel, whatever it was. And there's jewelry, and by the time she walked in, there was already jewelry, you know, all over the place. Which means he's you know, flashing, you know, the money and so on, essentially saying, yeah, you know, Yitzchak comes from a good family, but we're also a wealthy family, which just makes it a little bit more enticing. And here, that all the Yaakov can say is, yeah, I come from a good family, and he has nothing. Which goes back to where we began: is that Yaakov has nothing. Yaakov has nothing. He sleeps on the floor. He doesn't check into a 5-star hotel. He sleeps on the floor. Yaakov has nothing, and he's happy with clothing on his back, and he's happy with bread on his, and bread, by the way, going back to Bereishit, comes back only from hard work. From the sweat of your brow, you're going to bring bread. And Yaakov seems to embrace that and say, okay, please, you know, some people can sweat and not bring bread, and it doesn't work. He's saying, okay, you know, but at least just give me bread and give me clothing. Yaakov is very minimal expectations and requests of God, but this, I think, is a really a key point that when we do compare the two stories, maybe actually it's a little closer to when Moshe shows up, but even Moshe shows up, the Midrash is very strong about this, that Moshe still is wearing his Egyptian clothing. He still is, which is regal clothing, aristocratic clothing, so meaning Moshe still will make some kind of impression, and Yaakov's been, you know, I don't want to say call him a hobo, but he's been sleeping on the streets, and he's been he is arriving there from a very, very different, shall we say, socioeconomic situation, which actually is something which should trouble us. Well, why is this? I mean, what in the world is going on over here? And there's another point: what's easier, to make a lot of money or to hold on to a lot of money? I'm just saying, in terms of the history of the world, what is easier, to make a lot of money or to hold on to money? Certainly the 20th and 21st century, it's easier to make money than to hold on to money. You have children who squander money and you have parents who make money, but I don't know what to say about wealthy, because I suspect that it has to do with owning land and so on, but then again, the Jews very often don't own land. which makes money very, very difficult, which means you have to go back and then to wonder, okay, how exactly did Avraham or Yitzchak make their money? Did they make their money by, well, was it really farm work? I mean, there's very little about this when we go back and think about the lives of Avraham and Yitzchak. Did they make their money because they had flocks? Do they make their money because of trading? You know, how did they make their money? And is it still around? So hold on to that for a second, and we'll see, like everything else, that as well will be debated. But what's more interesting to me at this point is the distinction between those two stories of this Eved Avraham Eliezer showing up with all kinds of wealth, which may make the shidduch a little bit easier, versus Yaakov showing up and saying, okay, I'm Yaakov, okay. Basically, I can imagine Laban. You know, the Midrash goes out of the way there. He's patting him down. He even kisses him to check what's in, you know, see if there's any gold in his teeth. You know, it's really saying he's looking for the money. And that's what it's trying to say. But of course the Midrash should say he's looking for the money. Why? Where's the money? Which, by the way, also should concern us a little bit. Why does he go with nothing? So before you tell me all kinds of interpretations, let's just go on a little bit more. So he gets all the information who this is. Yudalid v'yomel olavan ach atzmi u'besariyata. You know, you're my flesh and blood, your family. V'yeshiv imachodesh yamim, and he spends a month there. V'yomel olavan Yaakov achi achi ata v'avadatani chinam. Hagid alima maskaratech. You know, I've been taking advantage of you, which will become a long-term thing. And, you know, tell me what your wages are. U'lavan shnei banot shem agdola leya v'shem agtana rachel v'nei leya rakot v'rachel tayifat torah v'yifat mar'eh. V'yahav Yaakov et Rachel, and Yaakov loved Rachel. The question is this when the love first emerges, or was the love the second that he saw her on that in the field? The second she comes over, does he look and he was told to go to find Lavan's daughter. So as soon as he finds Lavan's daughter, plus we're given this other piece of information, just like you know. In terms of the Chatan, I'm sorry if this is going to come off terribly sexist, but in terms of the Chatan, you know, rich or poor, it's good if he's got a lot of money. And in terms of the Kala, it's nice if she's really quite attractive. So over here, he sees her and she's really attractive and she's the one who he's going for. So does he fall in love? Is this love at first sight? Or you can say, no, we don't like that. This has to be much, much deeper, and there's something which is he meets her and he learns her, and there's some kind of deeper connection. I don't care, by the way, but which one it is. But what we do find is that he loves Rachel. V'yoma evdecha sheva shanim b'Rachel bitcha ketana. I will work for 7 years. Now again, you just have to stop there, which means as opposed to the Eved Avraham walking in and just throwing some money over here, we now find that Yaakov has been enslaved. This is to pay for the dowry. He has to work, right? So that's really interesting. Is that Yaakov feels this need to work for 7 years? Of course, when you're negotiating with Lavan, even if you say Rachel bitaktana, it's not necessarily going to be enough, and they get switched. So I'll just point out one thing, and this should be completely obvious, and there's no way that I could be the first one to say this, because it's just pshat. I mean, there's nothing else you can do. And that is that Yaakov may very well feel that he has to work for what he gets, that there is no blessing coming down from heaven. He has to earn it. It's the angels have to go up, and then they come down. Yaakov needs to work. And so you're asking, why does he offer so much? It could be that this is his way. You want to call it tshuva, you want to call it tikkun. He knows that he has to do this in a way that he is deserving of what he gets. It has to be from the sweat of his brow, because the brachot are not forthcoming, and he has no expectation of the brachot. He's not expecting it. He's not banking on it. He is going to work for this. So now you're asking, it's a great question, but why make that offer so long? Because for him, this has to be something which is real. If I just continue with this, and then right afterwards when they get switched, how can Yaakov not feel that this is at least karma or a punishment? Because he switched places with his brother, and when he switched places with his brother to deceive his father, so he's quite deserving of his wife's of his wife switching places with the sister, where the old, especially with the older one taking place of the younger one, as punishment for the younger one taking place of the older one. So how can Yaakov not look at this whole situation that he's in and essentially say, okay, I'm getting what I deserve? And I'm saying that all of this goes back indeed to the brachot. Again, the bracha that he stole and the price that he's paying for it, which would seem to be this dual price. And again, if you continue what happens, he ends up having to work another 7 years for Rachel. And he does accept that. He does embrace that. But anyone else would say, what you did is vile, and I did not intend to marry her. And even to the point of that, you know, I'm divorcing, I'm getting rid of her. But Yaakov seems to take his punishment. And the fact that he's willing to work another 7 years, which, I mean, is this really a case of crime and punishment? Is this really a case of Yaakov seeking out his punishment, which on some level he believes that he deserves? And I'm going to say it again, maybe this image or this vision of the angels going up and then coming down is something which has impressed him greatly, because he has come to this realization that this is the way that it has to be. You have to work hard. Yaakov has developed a work ethic. But I'll go back now and I'll say, so where's the first time that we see this work ethic? Where's the first time that we see Yaakov really extending himself or doing something that's quite difficult? That goes back to uncovering the well. Because again, all these men are going to do it, and Yaakov then uncovers this. So we'll look at the Chizkuni in source number 2, and then we'll look at Rashi 8, unless you want to do the other way around. But the Chizkuni is just a little bit broader, and he says, Kol HaParsha Hazot, everything we just now read, Ad V'Yigalata Evan, sorry, Til V'Yigalata Evan, Lo Nichtava Ela Lahudia Kama Gadol Kochel Sheyakov. This whole thing is to talk about the Koch of Yaakov. Let's just read Rashi, and then we'll comment on it. Rashi is number 8. V'Yigash Yaakov V'Yagel, Kimi Shema Avir Tapkak Me'apia Tzluchit, which is the language of the Midrash, Lohdiacha Shekocho Gadol, to tell you how strong Yaakov is. And that's also interesting, because we're, I think, guilty of projecting Yaakov as being a weak yeshiva student, for the simple reason that on a Midrashic level, Yaakov, who sits in the tents, is the tents are tents as a learning. So automatically, Yaakov doesn't have a tan. He's like, he's little, right? Esav is nice and strong, and Yaakov is this weak yeshiva bacher. Now, how does this, exactly that get reconciled with Yaakov seems to have enormous strength? So are you going to tell me that Yaakov, A, always had this strength, Yaakov was always quite strong, which is also interesting in terms of his fear of Esav? I mean, how close are these protagonists in terms of physical strength? Yes, Esav's a hunter, but Yaakov seems to have great strength. Or do you want to tell me that on a natural level he never had this kind of power, and then God gave him some kind of power right now, which was supernatural, in order to perform this? Which, by the way, I'm not exactly sure why you would be tempted to tell me that this is something which is supernatural. Well, why do you want to read a supernatural feat within this narrative over here? It sounds to be quite the opposite, that Yaakov is far more formidable than we ever had imagined before, and that we were guilty of that projection of hearing that he's a ish time Shebo Halim, therefore would seem to say that Yaakov is a wimp. Lo. In Hebrew you would say, Yaakov Avinu lo friar. Yaakov Avinu, Yaakov is tough. Yaakov is much tougher than we had ever imagined that he was, but that doesn't mean that he's not sensitive, right? Strong men are allowed to be sensitive as well, that he does have this sensitivity to him, as we see the crying in this exact same scene. But just look what Yaakov has displayed in this one little narrative. He has displayed, on the one hand, enormous strength. On the other hand, he has also displayed enormous vulnerability. So that's just very interesting in terms of the character who's being presented to us. Good. The Ramban, source number 4. V'tam ki ro'ahi. Why did it say that she is a shepherd? Lagid ki ein letzon lavan ro'eh achar zulata. To say that he didn't have anybody else. Now that's quite interesting. Why doesn't he have anybody else? And now I'm just flipping the question around. What about Lavan's wealth? Lavan has no one to work for him? You have to send out your little girl to be the shepherd in a place with all these... I mean, is there danger involved? Finally. Finally. Right, but correct. But there is a little bit of vulnerability to send a girl out by herself. And I'm going to go back to the issue of age over here. Do I have to spell out the vulnerability issue over here? This is something which is really quite interesting in terms of what kind of person is going to be sending out, you know, by the way, you have flocks, so go do it yourself. I mean, meaning, why does she have to be the one who's going to be out with the flock? Is he a wealthy man? Does he have a whole bunch of people working for him? Does he have sons? Don't say anything about his sons yet. Does he have sons? why in the world is this girl, I call her a girl, you want me to call her a woman, Tina? I don't know how old she is. I told you, that's part of my problem with this. And I do think it makes a difference in how we understand this whole episode. But he starts out to say, "Lagid ki ein litzon levan roya achar zulata." He doesn't have anyone else. Ki la levada masar via eder, vihi levada roel tam kol yamim, lo telech bohem leah achol takla. But Leah never went out. And it's not the same as having seven girls together, because even seven girls, the vulnerability issue shifts a little bit when you have at least numbers. So it's interesting. Maybe we don't know what her weak eye situation is, so maybe she couldn't go out. Maybe there is an age difference over here, that Leah is of age where she would be more of a target if there were men about, and therefore he felt that I can't send Leah out there, but Rachel's too little, that is, doesn't wonder, which of course is not necessarily true. Aval Yitro nechbad bimkoma v'kohin aretz v'yiru migeshet el benotav. So he says sociologically, Yitro, who's the Kohen, we don't know what Kohen means, if it's religious or a secular term, but he has a leadership position, so it could be that Yitro in a leadership position, his daughters were in a little bit of a better situation, that people would be more reticent to start up with his daughters. So there's numbers and there's his reputation and so on. So therefore, but you notice what he's doing, of course. He's making that comparison that I said we need to make between the whole Yitro's daughters episode and between the Lavan daughter episode. Oshe Lavan tsanua mimenu, or Lavan was more tsanua ki mishpachat avim ksheira v'tsnua, v'rachel hetakna tana ve'ein lachushla. So now he just now said, well, maybe the other way around. Maybe it's because there's so much tsniut in this family, and again, Rachel is very young. So Ramban is playing with this. Of he sees the two sisters at different ages, which means essentially he sees Leah as developed and he sees Rachel as not. And again, you could say to the Ramban, this is all wonderful. How do you know any of this? Mm-hmm. But he's just trying. He's grappling with the narrative and he's trying to figure out what's going on. So therefore, he suggests this. Just trying to finish this. Vizeh inyan, because she's young and she's not developed, this is what, now you'll see why he had to say that. Vizeh inyan v'yishak Yaakov l'Rachel. That's why Yaakov kisses her, because she's a little girl. So he's then saying, okay, it's not as inappropriate as you may have thought. Oh, who could ever be Avraham? Ki nishika bilamid, he quotes here the Ibn Ezra, bilamid, remember we noticed that before, einenu bapeh. When it says that you li Rachel is not et Rachel. He doesn't kiss her, which would be a reciprocal kiss, which would be a kiss on the mouth. Rather, rak nashak ota al rosha ol al ktefa. He kissed her on her head or on her shoulder, which would be more of a...
familial.
Again?
Familial.
More of a greeting than it would be something which would have any kind of an erotic side to it. And now you realize why the Ramban went in that whole direction in the first place, in order to make Rachel somebody who is not the object of an inappropriate advance by Yaakov. Till she grows up. Perhaps. I thought of that as well. So the age and the time does make a difference. Of course it is. That's my wife, the second she saw me. She's not here to defend herself, right? Okay. Till she told me. Source number five. The Al Sheikh would just jump in the middle where it's underlined. Ki adasha lo ba Yaakov le Beit Lavan, lo hayal Lavan, lo nechasim ve lo banim zecharim. Vze yomar ata bevo Yaakov Rachel ba al tzon lo mer ki lo yula aviha yoter me elu shenarak tana tereet kulan ki kimat hayu vegam banim lo hayu lo ki lo ki halo roim hi veim hayu zecharim lo hayta hi roa. So again, a little sexist, if you will, but he's saying it can't be that he had sons. But we know later on he has sons. So what he's saying, well, just to think about this logically, he's saying, okay, she, again, he's accepting that she's a little girl. So if she's a little girl, there must be a really small flock, which means that when you really think about it, Lavan does not have any wealth of this. He doesn't have any sons, doesn't have wealth, doesn't have much, has a couple of daughters and has a couple of animals, but this is nothing impressive. Why would he say all of this? Because he's going to say that, sort of like we're going to find later on with Yosef, that wherever Yosef goes, people become very successful. And also Midrashim, when Yaakov comes to Egypt afterwards, it becomes very successful. So when Yaakov comes to Lavan's house, and Yaakov works all those years, suddenly Lavan becomes a very wealthy person, which, you know, is evidenced as we move on later on in the parsha. But he's stating that now when he comes, we actually now have a better shidduch than we thought, because they both don't have money. I mean, that's part of what I wanted to get out of this, is that Yaakov is walking in empty-handed, but on the other hand, Lavan is basically empty-handed as well, and things are a little bit more even than we would have imagined. The Malbim, again, tells us to look back at the Be'er of Yitzchak and of Moshe, again, to go in both directions. Ve'ech ba'u ima gam kinson Lavan shemehem haya atid litasher, in source 6, v'agav nida mizesh Lavan haya ani be'etahi. So we see the same, the Malbim echoes the Al-Sheikh preceded him. Achar she bito aktana ra'at kol tzanova v'dim lo yulo v'kol ashro haya yidei Yaakov k'ma shekhtav k'ma at asher haya lecha lefnei v'yifrotz la'rov. Which means he's saying, again, he goes almost exactly word, not word for word, but almost exactly what we saw before the Al-Sheikh, but he just goes and ties it up and says, and all the wealth came subsequent to Yaakov being there because of Yaakov's work. If you're looking for now a commentary who's not as gender biased in terms of the appropriateness of a woman being a shepherd, is the Nitziv in Suras number 7, Kiro Ahi. Don't be bothered by why Lavan gave his flock to his daughter and not to servants. The Torah gave you the reason. Ki ro'ahi, that's who she is. She's a shepherd. She's trained in this area. So she was the best shepherd there. So therefore she's a shepherd. So he understands the words. Because she's a shepherd. That's Kiro Ahi. That's why he gave it to her. That's what her job was. She was the best at it. So therefore, here we have some types of equality. While the others could have asked the question, and none of you gave me a hard time, how could it possibly be that a girl can be a shepherd? Over here, the Nitziv asks, well, of course the girl's a shepherd. She's the best shepherd that there is. So you can decide how much you want to use this Nitziv. In source 9, the Ketava Kabbalah is going back to what we noticed. And again, I think this is an incredibly important point, and we need to make a little bit of headway now because we are running out of time. He goes to this Achi Imo, Achi Imo, Achi Imo a number of times, and to me, what the Torah is telling us, that's really the main part over here, is this Achi Imo aspect. So let's just hold on to that for a moment. I'm going to come back to it. In 10, we have this Rav Hirsch, which is written beautifully. I mean, again, I can't evaluate what the German had said, but the way it was translated into a very modern Hebrew, it's beautiful. But essentially, he's saying that it tells us a lot about Yaakov's personality. That's part of what he's doing. He's telling you about his strength, about his rizut, and about who Yaakov is. It also says that Yaakov does this right in the middle, literally in the middle of the it's the line that's not underlined. Hein miyad acher, the end of the line, hainu danim hitnahaguto sheYaakov kimase abirut lenara yafa, that Yaakov acts like a knight, a knight in shining armor coming in to save the beautiful damsel in distress. But then he'll go on in the rest of it to say, but don't think for a moment that this has to do v'chos masher shalom mishicha minit. There's nothing sexual over here. Kimchush hatzedek. Right, it's his sense of what's right. So again, you'll see a whole rewriting of the story here from Rav Hirsch to make it politically correct and correct, morally correct in all kinds of areas. Along the way, he will also do the comparison with the Moshe story as well, which, as I keep saying, I think is important. In source number 13, we have an Ibn Ezra. The Ibn Ezra is on last week's parsha. And the Ibn Ezra is on the words, Vayivez Esav et ha-Bechora, and Esav detested the Bechora. Why would Esav detest the Bechora? So the Ibn Ezra gives an obvious answer, and the only question is if it's true. There's actually lots of reasons to believe it's not true. So source 13 will be the Ibn Ezra, source 14 will be the Ramban who will take him to task for this. But the Ibn Ezra lays out a very simple theory, and it's where it's bolded over here, Va'od Yishalu Lam, well, let's go maybe from the beginning. Barvursha ain la aviv osher. The reason from the very beginning of Ibn Ezra, why did he detest the birthright? Because his father was poor. Now, how exactly did his father become poor along the way? V'rabi mitma'u, ki azavlo Avraham amon rav. Avraham left him a lot of money. V'kilu lo rubi yameim ashir gadol minu rav. V'bali dey ono b'ziknutav. And now Ibn Ezra is going to build a beautiful circumstantial evidence, and no matter how hard he works, and most of it's last week's parsha, which is why I'm not going to go into it more than necessary, but he builds a whole case of circumstantial evidence. Why would Yitzchak love Esav? Because he brings him food, and he has no food in the house. Right? Why is Esav doesn't care about losing his inheritance? Because there's no inheritance over there. And he makes this whole argument. I saw Rav Yoel ben Nun wrote an article about this, and he argued that maybe one of the motivations Ibn Ezra, so this is why I'm blaming Rav Yoel ben Nun, maybe one of his motivations was because the Ibn Ezra was somebody who was very poor and had to wander from place to place, and therefore this character of Yaakov just now became very similar to the Ibn Ezra, who goes wandering around with basically nothing. So therefore, to answer the question of why Yaakov shows up with nothing, is because there's nothing left in the family to show up with. All the money has been lost. Everything's been squandered away. Now, of course, the problem with this, as the Ramban's going to point out, is what are you talking about? We find a number of times that it says it. So the Ibn Ezra is fascinating. Look where it's bolded now. Why would God do such a thing? Why would God make somebody poor? So I'm going to say it again. A poor man writing this becomes interesting. In order to inform us, lama Chaserma or enav. Why would he be blind? Same question. Why would God take something away from somebody? And don't try to push this away by some kind of drash. He goes, because there's a secret, and Ibn Ezra loves using the word sod. He loves it. I mean, he has all kinds of secrets in his commentary. And people can't understand this. So Ibn Ezra, once again, is very coy, and there's a reason for this, and the reason, and then now anybody can give any Dvar Torah they want and uncover the reason for that the Ibn Ezra gave for Yitzchak being poor and Yaakov being poor. But all of this is, again, it's just completely circular over here, because why doesn't Yaakov have any clothing? That's one of his pieces of evidence. He has to go borrow Esav's clothing to put on. Every point that he brings up has an explanation too, and I think a better explanation. But the Ibn Ezra says, well, look at this, and look at this, and look at this, and look at this. There you go. The only explanation that answers everything is that they were absolutely destitute, which of course the Ramban says that's absolutely absurd. Yeah. Later on, we'll find the Bechor gets Pishtayim, gets double the inheritance. So I think that maybe he's reading back. Now, part of what the Ibn Ezra is going to have to do is what he doesn't mind doing at all, is create an elaborate Ein Mukdam B'Mukhar to create all the wealth that they had was beforehand, and they lost the wealth, and so on. But as I said, I'm not sure how far to take it. I just want you to see that there really is an Ibn Ezra like this, and then a Ramban who will argue on this point. Look at the Midrash in source number 15. Midrash Rabbah, Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachman Patach, Shir l'malot ha'seinai el harim. And then we skipped a little bit of interpretation. Me'ayin yavo ezri, from where will my salvation come? Eliezer b'sha shahalach laviyat Rivka maktiv bei v'yikacha eved asara gemalim. And now it's going into Yaakov's inner world as he's experiencing going and looking for his wife. V'ani lo nezem achad v'lo tzemid achad. He doesn't bring one little piece of jewelry, nor does he bring, you know, one bracelet or one, nothing. Yaakov goes with nothing. And that's a very strong argument. V'chanina amar gedud shelchor, v'yeshua ben Levi amar shelachimo, elo she'amad Esav unatla mimenu. So here we have the Midrash saying, we'll see other interpretations in a moment, that he did have, but Esav went and took it all away from him, and that's, you know, he got a pound of flesh, but he didn't actually kill him, because he only said, when our father's dead, I'm going to kill you, but meanwhile, he took away all of his money. So you have one interpretation over here that he did send it, which means, again, what's the problem? The problem is, if Yitzchak had all this money, so then why does he send Yaakov to go find a wife with nothing? So the Ramban, on the top, very top of this page, Vilonatnu, end of the line, Vilonatnu biyad Yaakov hon ki barachaya. Why didn't Yitzchak give him? Because he ran away. Why did he run away? Because he was terrified his brother wanted to kill him. Uvelo yidiyat achiv yatzam in aretz levado. So again, exact opposite of what we just now saw in the Midrash, is that he runs away because he's terrified. Ve'ilunan lo hon v'avadim u'gmalim ayu mosifim bo kin'a la'arov lo ulahargo. That had he given him all of this wealth and all this stuff, that would have added fuel to the fire, and then it was even more likely that Esav would have wanted to go after Rabbeinu, or Moshe goes lo mimenu. And then he quotes the Midrash, and just for intellectual honesty, he says, oh, and there is a Midrash that he did give him all these things, and he took them, so you can decide which way you want to proceed with this. Rashi will tell us in source 16, it's very similar in the Riva in 17, Rashi writes, Lefisha tefar bruach hadash enech nesed imodok v'radat his crying to v'racha. Why does he cry? Lefisha babi adayim rekaniyot. Why did he cry? Because he knows the scene when his mother was courted and his mother was brought all of this wealth, and now he has come with absolutely empty hands, and that's why he cries. And then Rashi brings another midrash. Amar Eliezer Eved Avi Abba Hayubi Adav Nizamim Utsmidim Ugdanot Vani Ein Biadi Klum. But I have nothing. Lefisha Radaf Eliphaz Ben Esav. So now it blames it on Eliphaz Bimitzvat Aviv Acharav Lahargo. So this is a real interesting twist on the Esav honors his father. So Esav tells his son, honor your father. Go honor your father and kill my brother for me. Because he won't do it, but doesn't stop him from hiring a hitman to do it. Vihisigo, and he caught up with him. Ulefisha gadal Eliphaz b'chikol shel Yitzchak, but nonetheless Eliphaz grew up in Yitzchak's, on Yitzchak's knee, had a little bit Yirat Shemayim. Mashach Yadav Amarlo Ma'aseh L'tzivoy Shel Abba, and he says to Yaakov, "What? I have a conflict. What in the world am I supposed to do?" Amalo Yaakov, who knows all of the Gemara and knows that there's Gemara that says that an ani is nechshav kimet, that somebody who's poor is as if they're dead. Yaakov says, "Tul Mashav Yadi, take everything in my hand, va'ani chashuv kimet, and then you can say that you killed me because you took away all my money. It's as if I'm dead." So here you have this wonderful explanation of what happened to the wealth. I want to go back and I want to explain the narrative, what I think is taking place over here. And it's, to my mind, the most, again, I just think it's just simple pshat, but I want to explain what Yaakov was doing. What was the main verse back in source number one? What was the main verse that we thought gave us the most information? That was the verse about the Achi Imo, Achi Imo, Achi Imo. What does that verse say? Pasuk Yud, V'yikashera Yaakov v'Rachel bat Lavan Achi Imo, V'etzon Lavan Achi Imo, V'yikesh Yaakov v'yagela te'evim me'alpi ha'be'er, V'yishak etzon Lavan Achi Imo. What's Pshat? Pshat is that this narrative is strikingly similar to the narrative when the Eved of Avram arrives. What are we told when he comes? Back at source number 12 is that narrative. Again, Pasuk Tetvav, he who terem kilal daber, right? That was similar to what we had seen today. V'inei Rivka yotzeit asher yuldal b'tuel ben Milkash, eshet Nachor, achi Avraham, v'kada al shichma. Okay, no well here, but she already has the water on her shoulder. V'nar tovrat mar'eh, ma'od. By the way, now we know that Rivka is very similar to his mother. Okay, that, I think, is important. And she goes and she gives water. And she goes, okay, and I'll feed obviously your camels as well, which because he had so much wealth and he had so many camels was a great deal of work. I think what Yaakov is doing over here is he's trying to establish his identity right away. By taking the water and opening up the well, and then giving her the water, he is saying who he is. He's saying, I am Rivka's son. Because it's the behavior of Rivka is what he's doing. Which means, even though he has not introduced himself verbally at this point, I think he has absolutely introduced himself behaviorally at this point. By saying, very different from all of those, others who together can work and don't bother taking care of this damsel in distress, as Rav Hirsch said. But what we see, that's exactly what Yaakov is doing. But Yaakov is here, I might even say he's staking a claim. He's giving his business card, he's making an introduction, he's saying who he is. Which means what Yaakov is trying to do is to show that he's a son of Rivka. And as being a son of Rivka, that's really, I don't want to say that's the wealth, but that's who he is. And I think that that's then explains this entire narrative over here, is that when Eliezer does this, he's looking, is there somebody good enough for Yitzchak? And what Yaakov's doing over here is, again, he doesn't have the wealth, doesn't have the jewelry, doesn't have anything else. He's just trying to show that he is not just good enough, but he is a son of Rivka. And therefore, as being the son of Rivka, then this just then became this perfect shiduch, and he's hoping that she recognizes this right away. And as I said, that's what I think is going on over here. So again, as far as the Ibn Ezra, that he went poor, whether he was robbed and or so on, or he had to run, the Ramban probably makes the most sense, that he had to run away in the middle and he couldn't possibly bring anything. That doesn't stop him from showing exactly who he is. And it's, again, it's not a question of showing the bank account. So I'm saying, if I'm correct, then even that kiss that follows up is a kiss coming not from some crazy stranger, it's a kiss from somebody who just now showed really elevated behavior, and this elevated behavior is actually the behavior which is the behavior of the Avraham family, which means that the only thing we don't know is exactly what his name is. And it's similar now if we go back, you know, as soon as Eliezer, Eved Avraham, gets there, and this woman acts in this way, he knows that he has succeeded. The only question is, okay, so what's your name? So over here, it's the exact inverse of that scene, is that once Yaakov behaves like this, okay, we know who he is, and the only question is, so what's your name? So then he has to introduce himself and say, by the way, this is my name. But all that's clear already, all that's understood already, and therefore, even this kiss is a kiss of a cousin, is a kiss of a family, is a kiss which is something which is socially acceptable, certainly in the Middle East, because it's clear that it's family. It's clear that this is somebody who understands it, somebody who gets it, somebody who has already, meaning, you know, you talk about, you know, the what is it, busa, what do they call it, to kiss them both. So that shows a certain type of a cultural. Yaakov just now showed a very specific cultural identity, which is extremely elevated, and the last person to act like this was somebody who grew up in the same home. And somebody, now if you start to think about it, had many, many qualities, just like Rachel has. And it's this woman who's this beautiful woman coming from this home. So I'm not going to say he sees his mother. We're not going to get into crazy Freudian things. We don't have any Freudians here today, right? Good. So we're not going to... That's not the point. The point is, who is he looking for? He was looking for someone from his mother's family, and he just now found somebody from his mother's family, which means it probably was love at first sight. Probably the second that he sees her, he goes, okay, I've succeeded. And therefore, what does he do? He tries to act like his mother, in order to convince her that he's worthy of her, and therefore that would be the very beginning of this courtship, as it were. And maybe sometimes it's not a question of giving expensive jewelry, it's really acting decently. And that's what Yaakov does, and that's really what creates this shidduch.